Chalupas. Everybody loves chalupas. Oh, yeah, man. Chalupas, 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 chalupas. I know that truth was. Everybody loves the chalupas. Chalupas, and everybody chalupas, wants chalupas, some now. Chalupas. Mom, everybody loves the chalupas, and I am gonna show you how. Chalupas, chalupas,
if you really
chalupas,
want the chalupas,
then chalupas, I am gonna chalupas, show you chalupas, how.
Chalupas,
chalupas, chalupas, chalupas, chalupas, with chalupa in the name of Bosque. Chalupas,
chalupas, chalupas, chalupas.
My favorite network is Fox.
All is quiet on New Year's Day. The world is wild, it's underway. And I want to be with you night and day. Nothing changes on New Year's Day.
Hey everybody, this is Rish Outfield. And this is the Rish Outcast. And I would ask you to give me a moment of silence and listen with me. I'm at the family cabin. Well, not at the family cabin. I'm by the lake, near the family cabin. And my legs are covered with mosquitoes. But you know what? That's fine. I'm going to make this sacrifice for this episode. Feel free to send me a donation if you like. You can even donate right there on my blog page. I made a tip jar PayPal thing on the blog page. And somebody actually took me up on it. And it was really cool. So we're going to do the third part of New Year's Day today. And the fun thing, inadvertently, that has happened is that I recorded for the first time in May. And then the second time in June. And now we're here for the third episode in July. And you're probably hearing it in August. I don't know, there's something magical about that. And speaking of magic, I came out here by the side of the pond where you could hear the frogs singing. The frog is my favorite animal. I don't know why. Always has been. And this sound is amazing to me. It's super, super exotic. And yet, most people have heard it before. You think of marshes, you think of lakes, you think of summer, I would think. You think of princes in animal form. You think of a buttload of mosquitoes. I've said this before. I intended to do all three episodes of New Year's Day here at the cabin in one sitting so that you wouldn't get repeated anecdotes. You wouldn't get, you know, the same jokes. But it didn't work out that way. I just wasn't able to come up to the cabin until now. At least we got one. And I just thought if I could only do one, what I would do was go somewhere where you could hear the frogs through the whole episode. Now, if that's irritating to you, well, then you need to give me a donation over on my blog to get me to stop. Oh, mosquito landed on my forehead that time. I don't know how long this episode is going to be, but this is the episode where we talk about the ending and the motivation behind the story and all the normal post-story chat that I didn't include in the first two episodes because the first episode, we didn't even get the explanation of what had happened. I just ended it, not really on a cliffhanger, but after a chapter when you're just like, uh-oh, something bad happened. She just fainted. And then the second episode, you know, we can talk about what would happen if a year passed. But I've tried to pull my punches as far as dealing with the story itself until now. It may be that this will be a long enough episode
that I could have split it into four. But three is the number that I've chosen, and my worry is that there won't be enough blood left in me when I finish recording to do a fourth episode. So three is going to be it. Let us finish my novella New Year's Day, and then meet me on the other side and we'll talk about it extensively.
New Year's Day.
8.
Britt, Dave, and Rob started high school in an awkward way. First, they were given a simplistic test to get credit for their freshman year, which technically they shouldn't have got out of, since they only attended for less than 2 months. All three passed, even Dave, who nearly didn't show up at test time, on general principles. The next step was for each of them to meet with the school counselor, a boring young woman with a high-pitched voice who, in between recommendations for classes, confided that, need they ever talk about what happened during that year, her door and ears were always open. When they compared notes about it afterward, Dave moved his fist up and down in a gesture Britt didn't understand. Britt's best friend, Holly Hufstader, had changed in the year they'd been apart, though Britt had seen her 3 days before in her reality. The shape of her face was somehow different, and her hair was at least 2 inches longer. She seemed to be jealous of Britt, as though the girl had been off traveling the globe, experiencing new and wondrous things, and had left her friend behind. She still acted friendly, but spoke with barely concealed disdain, apparently thinking Britt had gotten away with something. The telephone rang constantly the first week, and semi-constantly the week after. Dave's dad called reporters bloodsuckers, claiming they had harassed him at home and at work when Dave first disappeared, calling him stupid and a lousy father. Now he wouldn't even acknowledge them, and told his kids to do the same. He seemed to be on friendly terms with Rob's dad, who Dave couldn't help but think of as Rob's new dad, since they had spent some time together during the investigation, and Mr. Peterson had paid him to paint his wife's car and gave his name to a couple of friends with similar paint job needs. The three young people had decided they wouldn't talk to reporters, though there had certainly been offers to be interviewed in the paper, appear on the local news, and one lowbrow nationally syndicated tabloid show. And, when the press discovered it couldn't bribe or bully them into talking, it went elsewhere. In her second week of 10th grade, Britt had surprised herself by going to talk to Mrs. Breathwaite, the head of the high school's journalism department, to see if she might get a position on the school newspaper. There had been no Tomahawk article, of course, and Britt would have figured she was done with stories and investigations, but that was what she knew. It was part of her, despite the bizarre experience she had with it the last time. Breathwaite was a shockingly fat 50-year-old with a head of unusually thick gray hair. She expressed skepticism at first and explained that they usually didn't allow sophomores into the class, but agreed to add Britt if she'd allow herself to be interviewed about her missing year or conduct the interview herself. Britt said she'd think about it, then went into the restroom to cry. Rob was mocked at school and after class by the same bullies who'd terrorized him in junior high, except now they were taller and smelled worse. He'd apparently earned the nickname Buzz Lightqueer from his time on the UFO, where they claimed he lost his butt virginity in a different way every night for a year. Rob tried to focus on the fact that his family was reassembled and that he was closer to Dave and the girl he loved because of the experience, and it somehow made it all bearable. Perhaps sensing this, the bullying and mockery quickly died down, and by the time December came along, things were actually better for him than they had been the year before. And yes, the three of them did spend more time together, sitting in the lunchroom or going over to the combination Taco Bell and Pizza Hut a block from the school. They took comfort in each other, and even found ways to laugh at their new hardships. Another positive was that, according to their birth certificates, they'd all be getting their driver's licenses a year early.
Dave and Britt had only to wait until Christmas week and New Year's week, respectively, with Rob out of luck until the spring. And that was a huge bonus. Along those same lines, they'd all be done with high school a year early, which seemed like an attractive proposition when test time came around. "You'll get to date a year early, too," Rob commented, remembering that Britt's parents had ruled that she wait until she was 16 to go out with boys. "That's right," Britt realized, brightening. "Though knowing my mom, she'll probably push the deadline till I'm 17 in this case." Dave grunted and took a swig of his Mountain Dew. "God, I hate parents." Britt and Rob shared a look, but said nothing. They suspected that things weren't getting better for him, at home or school, and that he wasn't acclimatizing to the new situation like they were. They agreed to give it time, but that didn't seem to be working for their friend. Changing the subject, Rob said, "Dave, you've got to come over and watch Fellowship with me tonight. It's even better than I thought it'd be." Dave made a noncommittal sound. "Holly said Spider-Man was really, really good," Britt offered. Dave didn't respond to that either. Yeah, there had been new movies since they'd been gone, and new music, but there were also new problems and new worries. The fact that the other two didn't constantly think about the Lemley house baffled Dave, but since they didn't want to talk about it, he didn't bring it up. "My parents got me that for Christmas," Rob boasted. "Man, I can't wait." Dave rolled his eyes.
"Christmas of 2002, Rob. That's a year away."
Rob looked at him, and you could literally see him straining to try and get the joke.
"What do you...
Don't you guys ever wonder what happened in that house?"
He looked from one to the other, like Ben Matlock giving his big closing. Rob sort of half shrugged. Britt started to answer, but hesitated. Dave continued.
"Don't you want to know what we saw in there?"
"No, frankly," Britt said, and was eager to move the subject back to movies.
"You're kidding, right?"
Dave asked, trying not to lose his temper. He turned to Rob.
"Doesn't it tear you up inside?"
"Nope, not really."
"Well, it does me. Every hour of every day, I try to force myself to remember. I go back in my head and always get about an inch away. Then I lose it again."
"You're losing it now," Rob said, all of a sudden angry at his friend.
He didn't really even know why, but it irritated him that Dave could not let it go. Would not let it go.
"Look, what if we didn't see anything? What if we can't remember because there's nothing to remember?"
Dave got in his face. Right now, he was more frustrated than angry, but the scales were tipping.
"Of course we saw something. Something our minds are blocking out. Would we have been screaming for nothing?"
"I don't remember screaming," Rob lied.
"Right," Britt said, which sounded like an agreement with Rob.
"Oh,"
Dave said, pushing the anger down to the pit of his stomach.
"Okay."
He said okay as if saying, "Okay, I see how it is." He'd seen on a TV show a guy who conditioned himself to count to 10 when he was at a tipping point like this, and mentally did the same. Then he looked at the one uneaten breadstick in front of Britt Peterson.
"You gonna eat that?"
Dave came awake with a start. Again. He was almost used to it now. Almost. He reached beneath the cot for the pen and paper he had stashed there for just this occasion. He found the paper, but the pen was gone. As he fumbled there in the dark, he was aware of the vulnerability of his position. It would be easy for something rotted and wet to grasp his hand there under the bed. But nothing did.
"Remember. Remember,"
Dave muttered to himself. He found the pen at last and pulled it back up fast enough to scrape his fingers on the edge of the cot. He ignored the pain, writing what he recalled of his dream as fast as his hands would work. Already, though, it was retreating, like a nightcrawler when you shine a light on it. He got 3 sentences down. It was a Saturday morning, and Rob was planning on sleeping in. Not too late, the family was going into town to do some Christmas shopping that afternoon, and he wanted to finish the book he was reading, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, which had come out while he'd been gone. He was in the deepest part of sleep, though, when the knocking sound brought him out of it. He opened his eyes, trying to figure out what was happening. Sometimes he would have dreams. Dreams that he was in the Lemley house. Or worse, dreams that he was watching himself enter the Lemley house, unable to warn himself off. Sometimes in the dream, he'd hear Britt screaming, crying out for help. And no matter where he went or how many doors he opened up, he could never find her. But this wasn't one of those times. The sound was coming from his bedroom window. The blind was down and it was still gray in the room. The alarm clock beside him said it was 9:07, which meant it was just about 9 exactly. He sat up.
Hello?
Rob, it's Dave, a voice outside the house said.
Dave?
Dave Letterman from the show.
His friend's voice was dripping with contempt. Rob shook his head, snorting. Wasn't a little confusion to be expected when somebody woke you up at this ungodly hour? He started out of bed. Then, experiencing a bit of the activity in his shorts that seemed unavoidable nowadays, he hunted around for his jeans before he showed himself.
What's going on?
He asked.
Meet me out front, Dave said. We need to talk.
A few minutes later, Rob's t-shirt on backwards under his jacket, they stood on the porch, shivering in the winter cold. Dave had been out for a long time, if his pink ears and nose were any indication. Rob didn't know what was going on, but his relationship with Dave seemed strained lately, and he had a feeling it was something to do with that night. Now more than a month passed.
What's up?
Have you been having dreams?
Dave asked.
Dreams?
Rob asked, a little guiltily.
Not those kind of dreams, Dave said,
though Rob hadn't even considered a kind other than nightmares.
You know, about the Lemley house.
Dave waited for him to answer, but Rob said nothing. Dave chose to, once again, ignore his frustration and simply went on.
Well, I have. And in them, though I can't when I'm awake, I remember.
Suddenly, Rob wanted to be back in his house, preferably with the blinds redrawn and the door locked. Perhaps sensing this, Dave pulled a piece of paper from his pocket.
I forgot everything again, but I wrote this last night.
He handed Rob the paper. Rob was afraid to look at it. He wasn't kidding when he said he didn't want to remember. He didn't. He could flee the burning city and never be tempted to look back. He wasn't like Lot's wife. But still, he glanced down at the paper and read what it said. It wasn't easy to read. What he could make out was,
Subthig, collecting in house wanted, use Lissy, helped, us prize was 1 year.
What does it mean? It was hard for Dave to admit it, but he didn't know.
I can't remember much of anything, but it made sense at the time.
Dreams are like that,
Rob said, remembering a dream from the other night when he'd seen his dead grandmother in the Lemley upstairs, and she'd pointed at him and said,
come with us. Come be like us.
So, what do you think?
I don't know, Rob said. It looks like you wrote the prize was 1 year. Do you think we got that extra year as a reward or something?
Dave considered it, but he really didn't have to. He knew his own bad spelling.
Price, he said. The price was 1 year.
Rob nodded. That sounded right to him, though he didn't know what it meant.
And the rest of it?
Dave took the paper and looked it over again.
Something collecting in the house wanted us. Something else helped us. The cost was 1 year.
Rob swallowed. That also sounded right.
The cost for what?
Dave shook his head, but he thought he knew.
The cost to get out of the house.
He put the paper back in his pocket. Something was going through his head, but he didn't know if he should tell his friend or not.
I gotta find out the answers, Rob,
he said at last, in a voice so low it was like a whisper. Rob looked at him, fear playing at the pit of his stomach.
No. No, you don't. Just forget, Dave. Forget and go on with life.
Dave didn't make eye contact.
I don't like this life.
And Rob understood. While he had returned to a better life than he left, and Britt came back to one that was pretty much the same, Dave's was considerably worse. Dave sighed and changed the subject all at once.
Rob, you should tell Britt how you feel.
This came as quite a shock, and it showed.
What? Why?
Just to say you did.
Rob opened his mouth to respond, then closed it again. Just to say you did was not adequate motivation. Dave rubbed his face. He seemed older than 14. A lot older. It seemed to Rob that there should be beard growth where Dave was rubbing, and his eyes were tired.
I don't know why she likes me so much, Robin. She
just does.
He chuckled, though it didn't really show on his face.
Yeah, I guess. But you know, I don't really get why you like her so much either.
Well, it's mostly 'cause...
Dude,
Dave said, putting up his hands. Rob stopped talking.
All I'm saying is, talk to her about it. Maybe, once I'm not around, she'll look at you and think, hey, that Rob Schaefer looks like somebody I ought to make out with.
They both grinned then, and it was real for the both of them. It was the last time Rob ever saw a real smile on his friend's face.
You think so?
Rob asked.
If that day ever came, I'd probably...
Then it sunk in, what his friend had said right before that.
What do you mean when you're not around?
Dave shrugged. Nothing, just talking. Then he added,
people change, go away, grow apart.
Rob was becoming really concerned here.
Not us, man. Not you and me. Especially not now.
Dave put his hands up again, calming his friend down.
Yeah, I know, I know. You and me, we're like...
Dave wasn't really eloquent, not particularly smart, and not great with words. For him, saying things like this was a struggle. When he'd written the letter to Britt early that morning, it had been even harder than this, in a way. But he had to try.
Robin, I'm happy you've got your family back. Your dad seems, well, like a real good guy. I'm glad for you.
But?
But my family, my life, it's kind of in the shitter, you know?
Rob nodded. Though he only had his suspicions.
I guess what I'm trying to tell you is, you and Britt are my family now. We went into that stupid house, and we got changed, and somehow we made it out.
And the world had changed, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. But we're closer for it. We're better friends. More than friends.
Rob was nodding, avidly, like Dave was saying things perfectly, the way he'd say them if he had the words.
Anyway, Dave finished up, I just wanted to say that. And thinking about it made me think you should say your stuff to Britt. Today.
Today?
Today.
Rob shifted, uncomfortable.
I don't know.
I do. Do it today. And after you do...
Dave pulled out a little envelope and handed it to Rob.
Can you give her this?
Rob took the envelope. It was sealed, but not heavy enough to contain anything other than a letter.
What is it?
The Hope Diamond. What do you think? It's a note. Pretty much the same thing I told you about my dream and what I think it means.
Rob looked suspicious.
Why don't you give it to her yourself?
I got stuff I've got to do today. I won't be free until later.
When?
I don't know. Later.
Dave looked down at his wrist, but he wasn't wearing a watch.
Tell you what, I'll give you a call when I get back. We can watch the new gay-ass Star Wars he won't shut up about.
Have you seen it?
No.
Then why do you think it's gay-ass?
Just a guess.
Rob let it go. Okay, so we'll do that tonight?
I'll call you.
Okay.
And good luck with Britt.
Thanks.
Dave gave Rob a nod, again seeming like a much older person. A grown-up, with grown-up concerns.
See ya.
See ya.
And with that, Dave was gone. Nine. Rob was distracted during breakfast, though he wasn't yet used to there being three people sharing waffles around the table. He put his dishes in the washer without a word, then returned to his room. And though his family wasn't going shopping until one, he never got around to reading his book. He tried to convince himself he didn't really have to talk to Britt about his feelings. After all, he hadn't given Dave his word, technically. But that would be lying to himself. And while he hadn't promised to talk to her, David thought it was important that he do it that same day. And he knew Dave only wanted to help. Besides, Dave would surely ask about it when he came over that night to watch Star Wars. So Rob ended up on Britt's porch, building up the courage to knock, as Dave had not 2 months before. He wasn't the praying man Britt was. Not that Britt was a man, but you know what I mean. But he said a prayer now, and rang the bell. Mrs. Peterson opened the door, an oven mitt on her right hand, a spatula on her left. She narrowed her eyes at him momentarily, then forced a pleasant smile onto her face.
"Hello, Robin," she said,
but the suspicion was still there.
"She already looks at me like a mother-in-law,"
Rob thought, then couldn't help but smile.
"Can I speak with Britt, please?"
The woman seemed to contemplate whether he was worthy of the meeting or not, and Rob went over his sentence again to see if he had been impolite. Perhaps an extra please could get her to,
"Just a moment."
She all but shut the door, retreating into the house again. Rob heard her knock on Britt's door and say,
"Honey, you have a visitor."
Before they got to the door, her mother removed the oven mitt and brushed Britt's hair away from her forehead. It would have been cute had anyone seen it other than her teenage daughter. Rob waited to see Britt's reaction when she saw it was him instead of someone else. When both Peterson women came to the door, Britt's expression was unreadable.
"Hey, Rob,"
she said.
"Hey, Britt,"
Rob said, eyeing her mother warily. As hard as this was, it would be about 800 times harder if Mrs. Peterson stood there the whole time. Perhaps sensing this, the woman looked at her spatula and said,
"Well, I've got to get back to the kitchen. Would you two like to come in with me?"
Britt briefly met Rob's eye, then said,
"We'll be okay out here."
Mrs. Peterson swallowed, that friendly smile wanting to falter.
"You sure?"
"Yes, thank you,"
Rob said, employing his good Midwestern upbringing once again.
"Don't be long."
And then they were alone. Britt looked over her shoulder, closing the door.
"You'd think I was just waiting for her to turn her back long enough to go over the wall."
Rob glanced around Britt's front yard. There were no walls there.
"Is everything cool with her?" "Yeah, I guess. I think in her mind, I'm somehow 8 years old again."
Rob nodded. He actually knew what that felt like. He gazed at Britt. She was wearing a baby blue sweater a couple of shades lighter than her eyes, and a plaid skirt that went almost down to her ankles. She hadn't washed her hair that day, and had the remnants of a pimple above her eyebrow. He wanted to take her in his arms.
"It's supposed to snow," he said.
She looked beyond him.
"That's good. It always gets warmer when it snows."
"I saw Dana Collins at the mall today,"
he commented, prolonging the inevitable. Britt squinted.
"Do you know she got a tattoo over the summer? I can't believe it." Rob knew Britt hated tattoos, so he hated them too. Before Rob could express this, Britt asked,
"You talked to Dave?"
"Saw him this morning. How's
he doing?"
Okay, I guess."
Rob began to fidget. This was not working, and it wasn't going to. It was stupid of him to come here. What was wrong with him? He was going to die alone.
He seems... Rob, is everything all right?"
"Yeah."
Britt couldn't see Rob's hands become fists in his coat pockets.
I guess I have something to say."
"About Dave?"
"God in heaven. No, about..."
The front door opened then, and Mrs. Peterson came out again. She didn't have the oven mitt or the spatula, but did have Britt's big hooded gray coat.
"If you're not going to listen to me, at least think, Britt."
She handed it to her daughter and disappeared again. Britt sighed and put on the coat.
"Sorry."
"Just leave. Run. Britt's mom was like a call from the governor."
But Rob didn't.
"Dave was telling me that we're his family, you and me. And I just wanted to say..."
"What did he mean by that?"
She was starting to look concerned now.
"What's going on with his real family?"
"Britt," Rob almost shouted, "just listen to me. I know you think of me as just some dumb kid, but I'm not. I mean, I am a dumb kid, but I'm more than that, you know? I love you. How hard is that to say?"
But it was hard to say. What if it destroyed their friendship? What if the awkwardness that sometimes raised its ugly head between them suddenly burst forth like a skeleton in a 3D movie, forever pushing them apart to never go back to the way things were?
Could it possibly be better to never say anything?
He had hesitated too long.
"Robin, are you all right?"
Damn, she had called him Robin, his baby name. And it was that little push that gave him the strength to go on.
"Yes, I'm fine. I'm better than fine. Mostly because I'm looking at you."
Britt searched his words for a punchline, or at least some kind of joke. And Rob forged on.
"You can't see it, because I think you're too close to it. But you're just about the best person I've ever met. Smartest, sweetest, most..."
It was a chore coming out, like childbirth.
"Beautiful?"
Rob's poor, unremarkable face had gone a shade of crimson, best suiting a severe sunburn victim rather than someone standing shivering on a winter's night. Britt also started to blush a little bit, but was impressed nonetheless. This was not something she ever expected from Rob, and knowing him as well as she did, she had no idea where he found the courage to do this.
"But I see it,"
he said, and managed a smile. A real smile.
"And if this world had better eyes, everybody else could see it too."
Rob could feel his resolve starting to withdraw and realize that, although he hadn't told her how much he loved her, how a frown from her was better than a smile from anyone else, how he had memorized the way her hair smelled, so much so that if a company could refine it and put it in bottles, he'd breathe that instead of breathing air. Still, he had said something. And a good something. He finished up, the best part of his speech now behind him.
"And if nobody does, by the time you're 29, I hope you'll marry me, because every other guy is too stupid to see it."
Britt sighed inwardly, not quite making a sound. Of course she had known about Rob's feelings. She hadn't known they were this strong, no, but she had known they were there. And it was too bad this couldn't be like the movies, and she'd forget about Dave, or the 100 other boys in the high school who somehow appealed to her more than her good friend Robin Schaefer, and fly into his arms. But things didn't change with the words. Except there was something. Perhaps it was only respect. Respect that he'd toughed it out and done this thing, a thing Britt had never dared to do in the time she'd loved Dave Earle.
"Rob, I don't know how to put this,"
she began, and didn't quite know where to go from there. Was she really going to say, "But I'd rather not ever get married than someday marry you"? What a terrible thought. no matter how nicely she phrased it. Even so, she saw the way he steeled himself. She could actually see him preparing for heartbreak, as if he'd known it was inevitable and forced himself into it anyway. The poor guy. And in that moment, she did love him a little bit. Not in the way he wanted her to, but love nonetheless. She changed what she was going to say. And it came out rather nice, actually.
But there's no way you won't have been scooped up yourself by the time we're 29.
He nodded. A good soldier. It was rejection. He wasn't so dumb he didn't recognize it. But it wasn't as bad as it might have been. Silence passed between them. Why in Superman's name had Dave put him up to this? Then Rob remembered the other part of his mission tonight. He pulled the envelope from his back pocket, handing it over with a, "Here." Britt paused before taking it.
"Rob, I...
It's not from me," he said, nearing irritation.
"It's from Dave."
"Oh," she said, and looked at the envelope. Dave's adorable, awful handwriting announced that the letter was for Britt C. Peterson, as if there was another Britt in Olive Ridgefield. She looked at Rob.
"What is it?"
Rob realized he didn't know. If it was some kind of love letter, then Dave was one mean-spirited son of a... Then Rob realized what it must say. It all made sense now. How had he been so stupid? No wonder Dave had spoken to Rob in person, but had only written Britt a note. She was too smart to listen to him talk, then say, "Well, I'll see you tonight."
"Open it, hurry,"
he said at once, hoping he was wrong, since he was wrong about so many things. She heard the concern in his voice, and by the time she got the envelope open, she thought she knew what it would say, too. She was right.
"Dear Britt, I think we were lucky to get out of the Lemley house that night. I think something wanted to collect us, like Rob collects comics. Something bad. But I think something helped us. Interfered. If not, we'd still be there. I'm not sure, though. And I have to know. Rob might not understand, but I hope you do. It's real hard not to remember where a year went. But it's worse when you can almost remember but can't. I need answers, and there's only one way I can think of to get them. You are a great person, special, more than my friend. I don't have a sister, but if I did, I'd want her to be like you. Maybe that's not good enough, but it's all for now. Okay? And I am sorry for calling you dude. I know you're a girl. I hope I see you soon. Love, Dave Earle."
Britt refolded the sheet of paper, too afraid to be touched or cry. Before Rob could wonder what was in the letter, she said,
"He's gone into the house."
"The house?" Rob asked. But as he said it, he knew which house. There could only be one house.
"But it's going to be torn down." "Dave knows that."
"Does he?" Had he been listening when they'd heard that news? Regardless, if the house was haunted and he could experience what they had all experienced again, whatever that was, then why would he go in there a second time? Rob vocalized this.
I guess...
she began, then thought about it for a moment before finishing.
"I guess he thought finding the answers to his questions was worth the risk."
Rob tried to put himself in Dave's shoes and couldn't do it. Nothing would make him go back in there. No exaggeration. Britt started past him, zipping up her coat and pulling the hood over her head.
"Come on."
He followed.
"Where are we going?"
But it was a stupid question. Ten.
Three blocks they walked, in silence. It wasn't late, barely 8 o'clock, but it was very, very dark.
A cold winter wind blew from the north, and Brit found herself sniffling in spite of her coat. Like Hansel and Gretel, they moved down the sidewalk, side by side. As they neared the Lemley block, Brit brushed against Rob, pulled his hand from his pocket, and took it in hers. He didn't comment on it, nor read anything into it. They were going into the lion's den, or the evil gingerbread house, to not mix metaphors, and needed to draw on each other's strength. They didn't know what they expected to find at the house. Not nothing, anyway. But that's what they found.
It was dark inside. Dark outside. The boards on the fence had been completely mended and reinforced, so that none of the ground floor of the house could be seen. Not only that, but two nasty-looking rows of barbed wire had been attached to the top of the fence, making the climb over quite a formidable task. Big no-trespassing signs were placed everywhere. More than were necessary, in fact. Apparently, since the trio had come out of the house, it had been the object of a lot of media attention and neighborhood speculation. Police cars routinely drove past, shining their big lights on the house and its property. As part of their investigation, the police had gone inside, apparently, and found nothing. Not even Britt's flashlight. But it was a big house, and they hadn't stayed long. Britt let go of Rob's hand, moving to the place in the fence where they had squeezed through the last time. It was solid and secure. Above their heads, Dave's jacket could be seen laying over the fence, punctured by barbed wire.
"Is that?"
"Yes," Rob said at once. So he was there, inside, right now.
"Maybe if we could see in there, we'd see his flashlight moving around,"
Britt said. That made sense.
"I'll boost you up if you want,"
Rob told her. She just looked at him.
"What?" "I'm wearing a skirt, Rob."
Rob could see that. He was just trying to help. Britt sized Rob up, then looked back at the top of the fence.
"I think I could probably give you a boost," she said.
Rob wasn't sure about that, but he'd give it a try.
"If you're sure."
"Uh-huh," she said, determined but not enthusiastic. Britt wasn't a big girl, but she was able to help Rob get up high enough to look over the fence, his chin at the level of Dave's cast-off jacket.
"What do you see?"
she asked, straining under his weight. Rob's shoes were cold and wet from the snow on the sidewalk, but she held him anyway. Rob saw nothing, just the world's ugliest house. It was completely dark, its windows reflecting no streetlights, and seemed to project cold toward him, like an open freezer door. There was no sign of... A light from the bushes shone up into Rob's face. He made a startled sound and bucked, falling away from the fence. Britt also cried out as Rob slipped from her grip and hit the concrete beside her. His feet broke his fall, but didn't hold him, and he dropped back onto his tailbone. Rob gritted his teeth, his eyes watering.
"Shoot, I'm sorry,"
Britt said, running to his side.
"Are you okay?"
Most of the pain was to his pride, so he tried to act tough.
"Yeah, fine. What was it? What did you see?"
She helped him up, brushing him off. Rob's left hand hurt, feeling scraped and raw. Later he would find two splinters in the palm. But he was all right.
"I don't..."
Dave's voice came to them from the other side of the fence.
"Britt, is that you?"
Britt could see the light from a flashlight between the boards, but nothing more.
"Dave, it's us."
"What are you doing here?"
"We came here to stop you."
"What?"
Dave's voice asked.
"To stop you."
"Good luck."
It was hard to argue with someone you couldn't see.
"Come out of there, Dave."
"No."
Britt looked at Rob, frustrated.
"Boost me up, Rob."
Rob was about to remind her that he hadn't given her a boost before because she wasn't dressed for it. But she had that stoic, unbendable look on her face, and there was never any arguing with that. Rob brought his hands together to lift her and winced when she stepped into them.
Don't look, she warned him. Your skirt is like a mile long. I couldn't look if I wanted to.
There was no amusement here.
Don't want to.
I don't, he growled. He lifted her up, her feet at chest height, and he surprised himself by looking everywhere but at the girl. Britt peered over the fence, getting a disturbing thought in the process. What if it wasn't Dave speaking to her, but something that only sounded like Dave, and it was just waiting for her to stick her head over the top of the... But Dave Earle did stand there, holding his flashlight, looking impatient. He had a backpack, overfilled by the looks of it, by his side, and wore a long-sleeved shirt and snow cap.
Hey, Britt.
What are you doing?
He sighed.
Didn't you get my note?
Britt ignored the question, glancing over at Dave's discarded jacket.
Aren't you cold?
I was before, but it's warmed up a little.
It's supposed to snow a foot,
Britt said. Below her, Rob asked.
Is it really?
Dave glanced at his jacket.
You'd better go home, then.
Don't go in there,
she said, wanting to tell him to come home. Come home with her. He could live with them. She'd be his family, just like he'd told Rob.
I have to,
Dave said, and she recognized her own stubbornness in his stance. Rob spoke from beneath Britt.
How long has he been here? Why didn't he go before?
She started to repeat Rob's words to Dave, but he had heard them.
I don't know, he said. A police car drove by twice, and I was sure they'd come back just as I climbed the fence.
But of course, that wasn't the whole truth. He had been there long enough to go in and come out twice now, but he had to build up the nerve. After Rob's, he had gone home to eat and pack up some things. Mr. Earle had gone somewhere with his buddies, ostensibly hunting, and Chad had wanted someone to proofread his history paper. Dave was impatient to leave, but knew his old man sure wouldn't help Chad out. When he'd read through the paper, brilliantly titled World War Toe, there had been so many typos and mistakes that David spent more than an hour helping his brother out. After that, they'd watched part of a football game together before one of Chad's new delinquent friends came over and invited him to go rob a liquor store or something. David known it would be dark if he hung around much longer, and the house would be a hell of a lot harder to enter at night. So he had sent out, riding his skateboard. Apparently it was now Chad's, having inherited it sometime in 2002, to the Lemley house. Even then, he hadn't been able to go in. Across the street, an old man was outside, putting handfuls of salt on his path and the sidewalk in front of his place, preparing for the coming snowstorm. The man had given Dave a suspicious look, but Dave didn't know if it was due to the Lemley house or the fact that he was on a skateboard, the antichrist of transports. When he dared return, he saw the aforementioned police car. Maybe the old man had called about a suspicious individual cruising the block. Drive past. It had started snowing briefly, then stopped as soon as it started. Dave again considered going home, but he was in this for the long haul. He waited until sunset before approaching the fence in front of the house. Then, all at once, he threw his coat up top and mounted the makeshift wall. Landing on the other side, he'd stood there for a moment, looking up at the house before moving to pull down his jacket. The barbed wire had done its job, snagging the jacket good and hard. He could tear it down, sure, but thought he'd leave it there for the return trip, when he could peel it off from the top of the fence. He had made it as far as the front door the last time. He'd got up the steps, aware as Rob had been about how the house seemed dark, though when he arrived, the sun was still an orange ball in the cloudy horizon. Then, try as he might, he couldn't get his hand to reach for the knob. It was as if it had gone to sleep from laying on it. How long he stood there, he didn't know. It might have been as long as 5 whole minutes. Finally, it was the thought of going to bed that night, waking from nightmares, and forgetting them immediately after, that forced his arm up and onto the door handle. Was locked. He tried it again. Someone had put a shiny new lock on the door, then nailed a cardboard sign above it that announced the property was condemned and the projected date of demolition. He stepped away from the door, looking around for a window or another way in, when he heard a heavy click. Before his eyes, the door unlocked itself and came open a crack. He supposed, in retrospect, that it was the house's way of inviting him in, of letting him know he was welcome. But it had the opposite effect. Dave had been on the other side of the property in a flash, already reaching to climb over the fence, when he stopped himself. He had to know, and the house wanted him to know. Why? Why did it want him to come inside? Surely not to ease his troubled memory or help him sleep better at night. Lights had distracted him as another car had driven by, slowly enough to make him wonder if they saw his jacket stuck on the fence. He couldn't see if it was the cops or not. Soon after, nature had called, and he'd been peeing in the bushes when Britt and Rob arrived. Dave said none of this now to Britt, whose little head was peering down at him with indignation between the barbed wire strands.
"Don't go in there, Dave,"
she told him, like a mommy telling baby not to put that yucky quarter in his mouth.
"I have to. Why don't you come in with me?"
"No,"
he heard Rob say through the boards. Britt agreed.
"We're staying on this side of the fence," she told him.
"Fine," Dave said. "I'll go in there and tell you what I see. I'll go in there and tell you what I see."
Britt looked down at him, her big eyes scared and vulnerable.
"Please don't do it, Davy. Please."
Seeing her like that did something to him. It touched him in the place reserved for Malamute puppies, Christmas specials, and long-distance commercials. But he drew strength from it, the strength to do what he had to do.
"I've got to know."
Just as the tears were starting to come, Britt heard an angry voice call out, "You kids!" She gasped, and Rob under her took a step back. She took her hands away from the fence just as Rob let go of her feet. Instead of falling to the pavement as he had done, he caught her around the waist, like a male cheerleader performing some routine. Rob let her down completely, and they both spun around. Across the street, an old man was standing in his yard, looking right at them.
"I've already called the police," he shouted. "You stay out of there."
"Dave,"
Britt called. She couldn't see him, but could see where his flashlight was on the other side of the boards.
"Go,"
he shouted.
"We'll wait for you,"
she promised.
"Don't. Just go home. I'll be okay."
"Dave,"
she said again. Rob grabbed Britt's hand and had to literally drag her away from the Lemley house. After a few steps, she began running, and they both retreated toward the safety of another street. Tears poured down Britt's cheeks, making it hard to see where she was going. Rob hadn't let go of her hand yet, and a minute later, she found herself leading him. They stopped in the darkened entrance of a closed bookstore and caught their breath.
"Do you think he really called the police?"
she asked.
"Probably. I heard somewhere that old people call 911 like once a month."
Britt stood there, worrying and feeling helpless.
"I'm afraid for Dave."
Rob nodded, but there was nothing they could do at the moment. Only wait. It was still very cold, but due to their brief burst of adrenaline, it felt warmer. As they stood there, it got warmer still. Big, light snowflakes began to fall. They started slowly back, and sure enough, saw a police car, one of the old-fashioned kind, driving slowly in their direction. Britt ducked behind a big blue mailbox, squatting beside it with Rob in tow. They huddled there, in the dark, clutching each other, again like Hansel and Gretel. The police car kept driving. Rob looked to see if someone was in the back seat, but it was empty. They stayed there until the car faded from sight, then rose. Britt could feel Rob's heartbeat through his sleeve, fast and heavy. Either he was terrified or on the verge of passing out. She rose to her feet.
Are you okay?
He did the same.
Fine. You?
She looked at him, their faces very close together. As they stood there, a larger-than-average snowflake landed on her cheek. Rob saw it and grinned. He looked like he was having the time of his life. Britt couldn't help but grin back. She wiped the snowflake from her face and flicked it at him. A droplet landed on his nose, and she was tempted to wipe it off. Maybe even kiss it. She shook her head, her grin getting even broader.
What?
He asked.
Nothing,
she said, and started back the way they'd come.
Let's go.
When they got back to the Lemley house, it was snowing hard. The drifting white flakes made it brighter outside than it had been before. The house, seemingly untouched by the snowfall, remained black and looming, as ugly as any castle in a Universal monster flick. Dave's jacket was no longer on the fence.
Did they get it?
Britt asked, meaning the cops.
Nobody was in their squad car,
Rob told her, meaning to elaborate, then realizing that nobody said squad car outside of the movies.
Dave?
Britt called, as loud as she dared. There was only silence in response, and the sound of snow falling, if that makes a sound. Rob looked for tracks in the new snow.
Maybe he already left.
Britt didn't think so.
Dave!
She called, wondering if Rob should boost her up again.
Oh, God damn it!
Came a familiar shout behind them. The old man was standing on his porch, staring at them from across the street, and looked to be only wearing his bathrobe. How nosy could one person be?
Hello?
Rob waved at him, feigning ignorance.
Do you know if our friend...
That's it,
the man hissed.
I'm getting my rifle.
And Britt and Rob once again ran down the street. They didn't go as far this time, but watched the Lemley house for as long as they dared. Dave didn't come out. Soon, a carpet of snow covered everything, them included. It was like a cartoon. Britt felt her nose start to run and wondered if Rob was ready to head home. He stood there, shivering, and she realized he wouldn't leave until she said it was time.
Oh, Rob. Well,
she said at last.
I guess we should head back. Maybe he's already there, waiting for us. Maybe,
she said, but didn't believe it. Rob couldn't really see that happening either. Perhaps 1 year from now, Dave would exit the house, without a clue that any time had passed. But if the Lemley house was finally leveled in January, and a park was built there, what would happen to Dave? Where was he right now, really? They walked back as they had the previous October. Only two instead of three. The snow was clean and fresh all around them, and they stayed warm just by keeping moving. They talked little, but thought a great deal. When they reached the crossroads of Champion and Goodall, this time, Britt let Rob walk her home. The end.
You hear that? That means we're back. I was going to record closer to the lake, but there were a lot of people there. There were kids on kayaks. And the worst thing that was that there was a dog. And it was silent until I got close to the water, and then it just started barking and barking. And, you know, I read in a book somewhere that dogs are able to sense when someone is afraid, and they are able to sense when someone is about to podcast. And it's just because of the way we've domesticated dogs over the centuries. Anyway, I couldn't podcast there, but I'm podcasting here, and most of the frogs have gone quiet. And I wonder if that's because a car just drove by or because... Oh, okay, so one will start and then it's a call and answer, but multiples answer and then multiples call. I love it. I don't know. There's something neat about that. It must be mating season because there were hummingbirds that were swarming around. And I know that's not what hummingbirds do, but it sure seems like it. There were two hummingbirds and they just kept running into each other. And one would fly a little ways away and then the other one would chase after. And then it almost seemed like they were fighting, but my guess is they were not fighting. Anyhow, I guess we've got some stuff to talk about. I brought my notes. I began this story. It was called Haunted House Story 2002. That was the original file name for the story. And it took forever to finish this story. I don't know that I'm a better writer now than I was in 2004, but I am certainly a faster writer and probably a more dedicated writer, but that is relative because I am far from a dedicated writer. It's a flaw that I hate about myself, and I'm often trying to overcome it, but it's not a flaw that's unique to me. Well, one writer in particular with RR as his middle name, yeah, has it worse than me. Sometimes I lose interest in projects. That happens a lot. And sometimes I get distracted by another project and start that and never go back to the old project. That happens quite a bit too. And every once in a while, I am stymied by a plot point or by, a writing session that didn't go well. And I just go, oh, gosh. I don't feel like this is right, or I don't know where it's going. And the story gets abandoned because of that. And this is a story where I didn't know where it was going. I have in front of me the original synopsis that I wrote in 2002. Two boys go into a spooky house, perhaps the old abandoned schoolhouse, on a dare for a night, or maybe not even a dare. Maybe something happens in there. Maybe nothing happens. Maybe it's scary. Maybe it's not. Maybe they make out. Maybe they don't. But when they come out, more than a year, maybe 2 years, have passed. Everyone thought they were dead, but only one night passed for them. That's the original one paragraph synopsis. And there's a little bit more about the ending there, but I didn't know how it was going to end. It was more the question of what would that do to a person? Who would believe them? What would they think had happened? Et cetera, et cetera. And I started writing it. Even before I started writing it, I decided it would be two boys and a girl. And then I've got like little journal entries that I jotted down while I was writing the story. October 11th, 2004. As of this writing, the story of Britt, Dave, and Rob is unfinished. The ending is in sight. Indeed, I'm hoping to have it finished by Halloween, but there's a chance I won't make it, that I'll become discouraged, or worse, lose interest in this tale that's been percolating for years now on my home computer. As of now, it doesn't even have a title. Sorry, I got lost reading the notes here. Sometimes I will do that. I will sit down with the intention of writing, and I don't know what to write. And so I just sort of write about my experience of writing. It doesn't count as far as words go, but it's certainly helpful in this episode of my podcast more than a decade later. There's a follow-up post, November 6, 2004. The story is very, very close to being done. It has ballooned out of control. Yes, but the end is in sight in spite of that. Then I talk about what will I call it. I wanted it to have something with year in the title, like the 1 year day or year of fear. For a while there, I was calling it the Lemley House. Although I chose not to because it's not really about that. It's about the three friends and the experience that they share. And then the aftermath of that experience. And so I thought maybe I could find a song title. And I thought maybe A Day in the Life by the Beatles. Or I could change it to A Year in the Life. November 10th, 2004, I finished the tale today. And it was quite a chore. The ending was the thing. And I decided to call it after U2's song, New Year's Day. Although I second-guessed that because the story takes place in October and a little in November, and January 1st is New Year's Day, but still, it's almost a... I was also critical of myself because it's not a scary title. But it has both day and year in it, and I really like that song, and so that's what I went with. And I've never looked back. I still like the title. And I finished it. I finished it then, November 10th, 2004, after having started it in 2002. And you've listened to it. You know how long it is. It's either too long or too short. You know what I mean? Too long for a short story, too short for a novel. That's something that I do quite a bit. I'm okay with being somebody that writes novellas. For example, Newfound Fame. I really like Newfound Fame. And I don't know that it would be a better story if it were novel length. 10,000 Coffins is a novella. A Mark on the Sky is a novella. These are projects that I think work at their length. And if somebody paid me to expand them, I'm not sure that they would benefit from expanse. But I could be wrong. Pay me to expand them. We'll see. I have here notes about the ending. I didn't know what had happened to them when they went into the Lemley House and that year had passed. And that was deadly to me. Okay, so here in my notes, I had two big questions that needed to be answered by the time that the story ended. And the first was, what would happen to someone who disappeared for 1 year? And then the second question, what did they see in that house? And realistically, I became aware, I began to suspect that there was no way I could come up with a satisfactory answer to that question. I was really freaked out about the ending. I can't harp on that enough. And I thought, well, what if I don't answer that question? What if the story ends and I've never said what it is? Will people want my head? Will people realize that I don't know what happened and they will feel robbed the way that some people felt with The X-Files or the ending of Lost or Twin Peaks? You know, that kind of stuff. A TV show that takes too long to answer questions. And I stumbled across an interview with Quentin Tarantino. In those days, Pulp Fiction had been around for almost a decade, and people still always asked him what was in that case that they were delivering to Marcellus Wallace. In the interview, he said, and it surprised me, that he knew what it was, but he wouldn't tell people what it was because he thought it was more fun to hear his fans speculate about it. And I felt like, wow, that's a much better answer than I don't know what was in it. It was just a gag. So I thought what I should do is come up with a definitive answer and not tell people what it is, but maybe put in a little clue here or there. So what I decided, and I've already said this, but I'm going to say it again, is I decided to sit down and write down what happened in the Lemley House. As sort of a open this envelope on the event of my death kind of thing. Then I proceeded to finish the story with that in mind. And I still really, really suspected that it sucked. I worried that people would hate it and hate me. And, well, I'm not sure that that's not the case. But Big Anklevich read the story, and he really liked it. This is back when I first wrote it, 2004, 2005. He read it and thought that it was really good. Then a few years later, when we were doing the Doonstief, he wanted to run New Year's Day on the show. I fought him on it. I was really hesitant. A, because it was so long, and I had not done an audio version of it at that point. But what he did is he printed out two copies so that we'd each have one when we narrated the story, because that's how we would do it in those days. We would do it from paper sometimes. He printed it out, and it was like over 100 pages. It was just insanely long. And I said, really, that doesn't dissuade you from running it? And he's like, no, I like the story. He never had a problem with the ending. To his credit, I guess. Because if he had, I probably never would have put it out there. I probably never would have made my own audio version of it, which you just heard. I self-published New Year's Day, both in text and audio. And I wrote an afterword where I explained a little bit about the story. And I said, you know, I hope nobody is super upset by the ending, or the non-ending, or whatever you want to call it. I didn't want people to think that I didn't know, that I was a hack, and I didn't know what had happened when they went into the house. If they think I'm a hack for other reasons, that's fine. And I remembered there being a part in William Goldman's The Princess Bride where he said, you know, we're going to skip over this scene here for various reasons. You don't need it to enjoy this story, but I felt like I had to cut it out of S. Morgan Stern's original when I was doing my best parts version. But here is the address of the publisher. If you really, really want this scene, then write to the publisher and we'll send you that scene. I was a kid when I read this, and I was just like, really? That's fascinating. And I did write to the address in the book, and I did get that chapter sent to me. And I can't be alone in that. I imagine that a bunch of people did. I just thought that was really, really neat. And so in my afterword on the audiobook, and I guess the text version too, I said, hey, listen, if you absolutely have to know, I understand, and I'll do the same thing. I'll send it to you if you absolutely have to know. And somebody took me up on it. And so, to my horror, I had to sit down and type up the explanation. And I didn't like doing that. But I did it, and I sent it to him. And luckily no one else has ever listened to or read New Year's Day. Small favors, huh? Well, let's talk for a moment about an alternate universe where we did run this on the Doonstief, and I was Rob, and Big was Dave, and somebody, a girl, a female voice to be Brit. I wonder what the reaction would have been there. I don't know if people would have been satisfied with the ending or not. It didn't happen. With the Doonstief, there would have been a lot more people that heard the story, which is good, but I wouldn't have made a dime on it, which is bad. And I don't know that we could have sat here for a half hour talking about it in this way. In this intimate way. Do you know what I mean? Do you find that solo podcasts are more intimate than group podcasts? They certainly seem to be in my mind. Oh, I felt so proud of myself when I finished this story because it was one of the longer things that I had written. I had so many abandoned projects. I still do. In the 15 years since finishing that, I have many, many more abandoned projects. But I also have a lot more pieces that reach the end. Those vaunted words, the end, which are the sweetest words, at least in my writing experience. And I was happy that I had finally finished something, especially because it had taken so dang long. Do you know what I mean? It's like when something is easy and it just flows out of you, maybe you can be proud of that too. But when something is hard and there are many times that you feel like, oh, it won't get finished, that might be more satisfying. Well, let's think of George R.R. Martin for a moment in our prayers, and how good will he feel when Winds of Winter comes out, and then when A Dream of Spring finally comes out, if it happens. I guess there's a very real possibility that it won't, but he's really struggled with it publicly. And I've vacillated between really sympathizing with the guy and really being sickened by it. You know, the difference between him and me is a little bit more white in his beard, and that there's a tremendous dollar sign attached to his Song of Ice and Fire books. And it's possible that someone somewhere has told him, you know what, just finish it. Half-ass it. Get it out there. The check spends the same whether you write a great book or a mediocre book. That's actually pretty true advice, pretty good advice. But it's not the kind of advice that we want to hear. It's not noble. It's not the purpose of art. And I have various projects that are incomplete, but haven't been abandoned. And some of them, sadly, will never be finished. I've got two Ben Parks stories, a novella and a short story, that are incomplete, unfinished, and I hope that those are ultimately finished and put out there and that people can enjoy them. I've got a novella called Balms and Sears that is very close to being done, but I started it over 2 years ago. I have a novel called My Friend of Misery that is very close to finished, and when it was just a husky short story, a portly short story, I did finish it. But ultimately, I just kept adding to it and adding to it until I realized, okay, this is a novel. Cool. But if I never finish that, it's not cool. It's a shame. I almost said it's a tragedy. It's not a tragedy. I'm not delusional. But it is a shame. It is hard to do everything that you need to do, that you're expected to do, that you want to do in each day or week or month or year or lifetime. And I'm never going to finish all those stories that I start. I would be better off to start fewer stories and not start something until I've finished it. We'd all be better off, though. The Rish Outfield who wrote New Year's Day is right here in front of you. Well, in front of the microphone. I don't feel like I have changed at all since then. But some things are more important to me than they were back then. Some parts of my personality have gotten stronger and others weaker, and I still have that struggle with finishing things, with getting to the end. One nice difference between him and me is that I have you, a handful of listeners who are really decent folks and are often encouraging and make me want to work a little harder, make me want to get to the end a little sooner. In some ways, that you make me want to be my best self. And I think that that is valuable. That is rare. And the 2002 to 2004 Rish Outfield would be impressed and jealous. So thank you on behalf of him for coming along this journey with me. I hope that you enjoyed the story. I hope that you enjoyed my reading of the story, and I hope that you enjoyed the after conversation and that you will join me in the next episode of the Rish Outcast. As always, you can support me in any number of ways. If you can't support me with money, you can give me positive reviews. You can go on to podcatchers and say, hey, the Rish Outcast is pretty good, or you can send me a nice note on Facebook or through email or comments pages. And yeah, you can encourage me to put out more, to write more, to release more, because I always need to hear it. Always. So did he back in November of 2004. So, I am old Rish Outfield, and I am young Rish Outfield. Thank you. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
The Rish Outcast was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which makes it free to listen to, share, and poke fun at. But the podcast cannot be altered or sold. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com for the music so inexpertly used in this episode.
Are you insulting him or me?
You.
Ow! Ooh, that one really hurt. I'm surprised. Thought mosquitoes had some kind of, chemical that they put so that you don't feel them when they first bite you. I don't know. God, you can hear that f***ing dog. And it echoes. It sounds like two dogs barking at each other, but it's the same friggin' dog. My legs are going to be black with these things. Oh, you know, I'm probably going to have to start walking. They're just swarming now.